Jennifer McCormick and State House Republicans. The DCS budget in flux. That plus tech leaders engage on hate crimes and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 8th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick once again wasn't shy about sharing criticism of education policies at the State House. In a tweet this week, McCormick lobbed criticism at the General Assembly's policymaking. She says after listening to Hoosiers, it's, quote, clear that Indiana's education policies are in question, and she adds that those policies don't represent the majority of Indiana families. This isn't the first time McCormick has shared critical views of what her fellow Republicans are advancing. She's been disapproving of the teacher pay proposals put forth so far this session. The state schools chief argues those plans don't dedicate money specifically for teacher pay increases, and she worries the proposals are blanket solutions that don't consider the varying needs of different districts. McCormick announced last year she won't run for re-election in 2020 and cited the, quote, unhealthy governance structure as part of her reasoning. What impact does McCormick's criticism of State House education policies have? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Phil Johnson, do you think state lawmakers are listening to Jennifer McCormick?
In a word, no, they are not. Here's why. Dr. McCormick has come out from the beginning and talked about the need to raise teachers' pay. We've heard this over and over from her again, and both in the House budget and the governor's budget, there's not a dime allocated specifically for raising teachers' pay. Two, talked about school funding. Actually, schools per pupil, when you adjust for inflation, was actually higher in 2009, a decade ago, than it was in this budget. When you pull public schools out of the school funding formula, actually, their increase isn't actually as much as inflation, so they're getting less money than they are before. Look, we've heard from Dr. McCormick is a public educator, and I think this comes down to respect for public education, and this is a test that Indiana Republicans have failed time and again.
This all comes, obviously, amid some significant changes to that office that are coming probably fairly soon as the bill moves through the General Assembly to move the date up when that position will be appointed to 2021. So how much does that play into these criticisms that she has?
Well, remember, we're only moving the date up because she said, I'm leaving, right? And so, like, when you do that, you give up your leverage. It's not like they didn't listen to her before, and her impact when she did have policy disagreements with Republican lawmakers in the past on education policy did matter and was important. But when you say, I'm not running again, you're at least a year, if not 2 years, before you actually need to say that, you give up a lot of leverage in that discussion because there's really no reason to listen to you anymore you're not going to be around.
Could she really afford to wait? Because it's not like they could have gotten somebody to run for what was only going to be
sure.
a one-year term. So in a sense, she did have to.
She made that decision. You have a 5 or 6 month window where you can go find somebody to do this. But the underlying issue here that prompted this was her criticism of teacher pay. But Phil's talking point is right. There isn't a dime in this budget for teacher pay. But there's also no mechanism available to legislators in state law unless they take over teacher compensation and take it out of the local level and regulate it and regulate that at the state level. We don't fund education that way right now. We fund it in two buckets. And locals have draw out of those dollars in order to set compensation. So there's just the process doesn't allow that right now.
Should it?
That's a legitimate debate, really.
Yeah, should the state take over teacher compensation entirely?
So I want to point out the fact that Mike said he agreed with me. That was fantastic.
I've been doing that once a week with Ann, so don't get too excited.
I think if they wanted to find a way to do it, look, there are a lot of smart policy folks down on Washington Street. If there was a way to find a way to compensate teachers, they could do it. They could find it. I want to say that there was a suggestion made to Speaker Bosma about maybe providing $1,000 bonus to every teacher. There's a way to do that. They just haven't done it.
I think somebody on this panel made that suggestion to Speaker Boswell.
Perhaps across the table.
The conversation around Jennifer McCormick, though, does this sort of emphasize why some people are upset that the position will no longer be elected because you have a more independent voice who's sharing criticisms even of her own party?
Well, sure. I think there is an instinctive quality among voters to say, you know, everything else being equal, we'd rather have positions be elective office than be appointed office. It's just the notion that that somehow is more in line with the notion of democracy and the notion of having another conduit or channel through which the public can voice its concerns. I think Mike's exactly right, though. This was the die was cast, so to speak, when she made clear that she did not want the job and made clear she wasn't really pleased with the way government was functioning in the state of Indiana, because there's a certain alienation factor there.
Why should she be? They didn't listen to her. She actually supports an appointed superintendent of public instruction, and they also haven't listened to her on a number of other things since she's been in office.
But if she, and I think, yeah, she has a lot to say and a lot of valid points to make, but if her, from a pure, crass political standpoint or the mechanics of this, the best way for her to have her voice heard would have been for her to stay and been vocal and critical. And then, because the story, as we get closer to the next election,
I'm not saying she's been vocal and critical before she said that.
But,
and so does that,
but now it's...
And so does that actually underline...
She had a seat at the table, and she doesn't anymore because she's decided to leave.
But arguably, the fact that she's been critical before and for the most part hasn't been able to affect much change, doesn't that actually underline why the position should just be appointed? Because it doesn't matter that they're elected or not anyway?
No. Well, at least in recent years.
Well, not only that, but then, I mean, the governor is then driving that policy. I mean, this was the whole argument about why this ought to be an appointed position to begin with, because the it is now the weight of the governor's office that is driving education policy, not the superintendent that no one really knows exists. And
certainly what they do.
I mean, it was the decision to appoint the superintendent was controversial last year because there was a person involved, right? And you were arguably undermining the will of the voters in the next election. Well, now it's an open seat no matter what, so you might as well make it an appointed position. And that is not controversial at all.
That has just kind of flown.
She may not have had her voice heard to the level that she wanted before, but I do think if she had stayed, if she had not announced her departure, as we got closer to the next election, you can't tell me that media outlets and others would not have said, hey, there is a schism here. There is a difference of opinion among two people at the top of the ticket.
In the last elected.
You're right, in the last cycle. And all of a sudden, then there would be, I think, a lot more attention paid to, gee, they don't agree. What is the right approach for the state of Indiana?
Yeah. Well, Department of Child Services again asked state lawmakers this week to increase its funding by nearly $300 million per year. But there isn't consensus among legislative leaders as to whether DCS will actually get that much. DCS officials have said for months the agency needs $286 million more per year than it got in the last budget. That figure matches what DCS is currently spending after state leaders shifted dollars over the last couple of years to meet a huge uptick in cases. But things are getting better. Caseloads are down and case manager turnover is decreasing. And that has some lawmakers wondering if DCS needs as much as it's asking for. DCS Director Terry Stigdon stresses the fluid nature of both the number of DCS cases and case managers. Both Senate Appropriations Chair Ryan Mishler and House Speaker Brian Bosma say they'll take another look at the DCS request after lawmakers get an updated revenue forecast in mid-April. Mike O'Brien, from a public perception standpoint, is there any way that lawmakers can afford not to give DCS whatever it asks for?
Yes, but only because something bad is going to happen, right? And so you've asked for, because that's the whole purpose of that agency, to deal in terrible situations and when children are at risk. So something bad is going to happen, and when that happens, if they asked for $10 and they got $9, someone's going to say, well, could that extra dollar have saved a life? I mean, that's really the debate,
Even if it ultimately wouldn't have made a difference.
But this is a fair debate in my mind, because the question isn't just about the money. So if you look at the problems over the last couple of years where they had to augment the budget, augment DCS funding, go draw from other agencies to make up for the shortfall and what they were actually spending, it was logical for DCS to then say, this is what we're spending, this is what we need. However, I think the legislature is looking at this and saying, but you have also made reforms that have improved the functionality of
and
the
agency.
And
there are more coming down the pike from legislation.
From legislation, and there's more to come. So is that really, that was the number of pre-reform. Is that the number post-reform? But it makes it tough when, I mean, it's kind of a classic like government move, right? We've invested all this money, caseloads are coming down, recidivism is up among social workers, you know, the right metrics are moving the right direction. And then because you invested all this money, and then you go, wow, we probably don't need all that money in there. We could spend that on something else. And that's a perfectly natural government instinct.
Is this a fair debate to have, though? I mean, things are metric-wise getting better at the agency. Theoretically, they will continue to for at least a little while. Is it fair to say, do you really need that huge budget number?
So you could pull this segment from 2011, from 13, from 15, from 17, and today. We've been having this discussion for so many years about funding at DCS and the need for more. I'm a little skeptical that we've got this problem solved and that caseloads are coming down. I think that we need to properly fund the agency. And that means more funding. Two, I think accountability and some accountability of that spending and what's happening at the agency is important. We need to make sure that the reforms that are happening continue to happen. In the past years, it's operated in this, like, look, we get out of the headlines with DCS and then we're done with DCS. There's a lot more to go, and transparency is important there. In the last three Republican administrations have proven that they just aren't going to hold DCS accountable. So the legislature needs to be more involved. Yes, I know that we have agencies we have committees that do that, but these same problems are still happening with those agencies already. Those committees already. We need more transparency there, a little more accountability at DCS.
So Mike kind of talked about it, we spent all this money to help solve the problem. We're starting to see the problem get better. So are they caught in a position where they can't take away the money yet, even though it kind of looks like they should?
I don't really see what the upside to not giving them their full request is. I mean, at worst case, they don't spend everything, and then that goes to the surplus, and you've got a great bottom line at the end of the year. I mean, I would rather do that than, you know, take a chance that something doesn't terrible happen, and then the headlines are, you know, the agency that the lawmakers refuse to fully fund.
Even if lawmakers agree to go along with DCS. Even if the resolution they come to here is they get DCS to agree, okay, we don't need 286 more. It's actually 270 or something like that. That everybody agrees this is the number. Even if they all agree that this is the number and it's lower than what they're currently asking for, does that create the same problem?
That certainly gives them more political cover. But keep in mind, as has been stated numerous times, the $286 million a year in additional funding is, in fact, what the agency has been spending to deliver the positive results in terms of the metrics that it has delivered. So it's not as if it's some projection that theoretically could
right.
be lowered.
That's
and
right.
I think the discussion here, when we talk about solving the problem, by definition, this is a problem that never will be solved because it's being held in abeyance. So it's, to me, it's like I have weeds in my lawn, and I do, but don't tell anybody. And I say I'm going to hire one of these outfits to come and, you know, treat it every month and take. Well, guess what? The weeds might go away. Is it logical to think, therefore, that if I can reduce my lawn care budget because I solved the problem? It's beautiful green grass. Well, guess what? I'm guessing if I reduce my spending and expenditures, it might reappear. And I think this is much the same.
Yeah. Indiana tech industry leaders say the lack of a comprehensive hate crimes law is a barrier to attracting talent, and those same leaders say they're ready to engage with lawmakers to advance the issue. Many in the business community want a hate crimes bill with a list of victim characteristics, and they were upset when Senate Republicans eliminated that list earlier this session. Clear Software CEO John Gilman says if House lawmakers don't add it back in, they'll give Indiana a, quote, black eye. In his words, such a move would reaffirm Indiana's reputation as socially regressive and not inclusive. As for what they'll do about it, leaders from the Indiana Technology and Innovation Association say they're asking their members and fellow tech companies to engage lawmakers directly. House Speaker Brian Bosma says his phone hasn't been ringing off the hook with voters advocating for the issue.
Nikki Kelly, we asked last week what would need to happen for House Republicans to add the list back in. Will this sort of thing do it?
Well, I mean, I think you have to do it. If you're supporters of this, you kind of have to put everything out there and say you tried every option. But, I mean, at least from talking to the Speaker and a couple other Republicans in the House, I mean, they seem really set. I don't even think they're listening to the other side at this point.
Yeah, what we asked this question last week. Now we're starting to see it. We're starting to see the tech leaders come out and saying they want to talk to local lawmakers. We had a bunch of national civil rights organizations send a letter this week and in the last couple of days to Republican leadership saying a bill without a list doesn't get you off of the big list. And yet still, House Republicans are like, we don't care.
Well, I don't want to say talk is cheap, but I mean, what we saw in the wake of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was not just criticism and not just people coming together and forming coalitions and saying we stand united against this new measure. There were actual tangible threats that it would have an impact on the state of Indiana, its economy, its ability to stage events with the frequency that it finds customary. So if you had, again, professional sports organizations, if you had the NCAA, if you had other groups that have conventions here, you want to get people's attention, that could happen pretty quickly.
Is that it? Is it at this point, is it threats that'll get the job done?
It's apparently not a Muslim man being murdered on the south side of Indianapolis because he's a Muslim, right? My theory on previous shows and just in general on this is that maybe it's something external that needs to happen. Well, clearly that's not the case. I mean, RFRA was so, everything kind of fell in a bad way, depending on your perspective, fell in line so perfectly, whether it was the proximity to the Final Four coming to town. I mean, that was within weeks of the Final Four coming to town.
You know, Mike Pence going on national television and not delivering the messages clearly
not
as
doing
someone
great.
Would like.
The photo in the office that made it look like it was taken in the 18th century. I mean, there's just a lot of layers to that that all hit at the right time and exerted a tremendous amount of pressure on the legislature. And that doesn't exist here. And I don't know how to you can't really manufacture it. It's hard to manufacture because people have to be motivated to make a decision they wouldn't otherwise make, whether it's pick up and leave the state, you know, close their company and leave, go to another state.
Or other companies or saying, we're never going to
come to
Indiana.
Or some other company says, we're never going to go to Indiana. It's just...
To that end, it seems that a growing consensus that anything short of a RFRA-like firestorm probably isn't going to move the needle on this debate this year. But can you really manufacture that?
I think you can... I don't know about manufacturing, but you can try. And one of the ways you can do that, you can have some grassroots, make sure they have a grassroots effort in every one of these legislators' districts. Yes, a press conference in Indianapolis is a good thing, but a showing up at a third house meeting in Vigo County is also effective. You can have the governor turn up the pressure. I believe that when the Governor Daniels was trying to have Lucas Oil built there, he was having town halls. We could see the governor do it, barnstorm the state and be in legislators' districts for a little in-district arm twisting and lobbying. I think there are ways to get there on this issue. I think that you can manufacture a little bit of that pressure. But it's also, I think the Indy Chamber released a poll saying that 75% of Hoosiers supported this. It should not be that hard of a lift.
That's almost part of it. You're absolutely right. There ought to be pressure in the districts. There is and will be a grassroots campaign to kind of go and target in that way. And that's all helpful. The bigger issue, though, here, I think, is just that when it died, when the list got pulled out in the Senate, nothing happened the next day. It was like when RFRA passed, the building blew apart.
Yeah.
And when the list got pulled out, and legislators learn that, and they see that, and they go, there's no downside. So I think the problem for the 75% is that they believe that it's so inevitable, and it isn't a hard lift, and this isn't a big policy change, that it's just probably going to happen. And if you believe that, and you haven't contacted your legislator, do it, because it's not going to happen if you don't.
Well, ironically, right. That's what happened at first with RFRA. There was not the groundswell, and a lot of the groups just assumed that it would be defeated at some point along, or it would get derailed at some point, and then if it didn't, then surprise.
Right. The walls fell down. The State House was the scene this past week for rallies advocating for measures to address gun violence, redistricting reform, and renewable energy. Student-led gun control organizations like We Live Indy and Students Demand Action gathered at the State House Saturday. They called for action both at the federal level, including a universal background check bill in the U.S. Senate, and at the state legislature. Meanwhile, eight organizations rallied at the State House Wednesday for policies that support renewable energy in Indiana. They're backing a House bill that prevents homeowners associations from banning solar installations, forcing property owners to remove them or making unreasonable restrictions on them. And this weekend, teachers will march at the State House to advocate for better pay.
John Schwanis,
I don't want to talk about any one of these specific issues necessarily. I want to talk sort of about the overall impact. So do these sorts of rallies produce tangible results at the State House?
I don't want to discourage rallies because I think that's a great expression of people's First Amendment rights and a sign that they're engaged in their governance. Having said that, they probably don't have a tremendous impact, especially one that takes place on a weekend. If you have lawmakers who aren't in the least bit inconvenienced as they go from their vehicles to their offices or out at the end of the day, or they can't, they have trouble.
Hear it from their office window.
Right. So I think, and it's easy for lawmakers to say that whatever group is there in force, in mass, is in somebody else's district. Those aren't my constituents. Clearly, the more effective thing would be something targeting each member of the House or Senate, which actually features their constituents.
Yeah, we just talked about.
Yeah, you get a few phone calls from real constituents. You get a few handwritten notes from real constituents. All of a sudden, that's a bigger megaphone in some ways than a rally.
John just kind of alluded to this. Is the answer to the question, do these rallies have an impact? Really, it depends.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen rallies at the State House over the years that really did have an impact. I see lawmakers walking by them and standing over the balcony and listening to people talk, and those can make a difference, especially when real people, so-called real people, are speaking. You know, not the so-and-so spokesperson or, you know, but
the
parents or kids
or,
you know, someone. So I've definitely seen them work. Obviously, though, the lawmakers have to be in the building, or the rallies have to be back where they are in their district.
Yeah. Again, I'm talking about an impact. So the kids marching against gun violence last week, the teachers showing up on Saturday for teacher pay. I understand why you do it on a weekend, to hopefully get more people, but at the same time, are you just shouting into the wind?
Brandon, they're in the classroom during the week, so it's a little tricky for them to come down during the legislative session.
You know, details, man.
So I think all the points that we talk about rallies at the State House and good crowds there, and we talk about the importance of being in someone's legislative district. Well, those folks come from legislative districts. They don't just come out of the ether. So they are there. It's important to apply the pressure at the at the individual district level, and a legislator would be able to see someone's face with an issue. No, I do. I think they're important. I think they're really there. They can be moving when it is an individual talking about an issue. And I think we've all seen that happen.
Yeah. So if you're consulting somebody, a client, and they ask you, how do you maximize effectiveness? What's the answer?
For them to be involved, because I'm not a real person to these legislators. I'm helping other people navigate the process and come up with a strategy for them to be successful. But you know, we kind of jokingly say we need real people to insert themselves in this process, because it's really easy to get derailed on an issue. Because when a legislator says, "Well, I got three phone calls from back home," that's a big deal. Legislators get three phone calls from the right people, or any people back home, because not people don't tend to engage. I think the best example over history was Orange County getting a casino with the orange shirts in the hall, and they'd load a bus every day and drive it and sit in the State House. There was no natural momentum to a French Lick casino. Those people came to the State House every day for years and made
the case. Keep in mind, you may not achieve the impact on lawmakers, but it also has the intended purpose of rallying support and zealousness among your own supporters. And I think for that reason, they can be effective as well.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: do rallies at the State House influence state lawmakers' decisions? A yes, B no, or C, it depends on who's rallying. Last week's question: should the General Assembly impose more limitations on school referendums? 61% of you say yes, they should, while 39% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana's public universities made their funding requests to Senate legislators this week, as that chamber's budget hearings are underway. The state's Commission for Higher Education began the hearing by telling lawmakers the number of people completing degrees is up 15% over the last 5 years. The university presidents emphasized that progress. Indiana University President Michael McRobbie says his institution's online classes are a major factor, while Purdue President Mitch Daniels used his pitch to emphasize his university's continued push toward lowering the cost to students. But the House version of the budget increases university funding less than the Commission for Higher Education recommends. The Senate budget draft will come out in the next few weeks. Michael Bryan, does higher ed funding get lost in the discussion?
They have a good case to make there of the new money available in this budget. 67% of it went to, if you take away DCS and Medicaid, 67% went to K-12 and 2% went to higher ed.
I think we need to make sure that we're making that our institutions of higher ed are properly funded. They're obviously important.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.